League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm here, as always, with fellow beat reporter Bob McGinn. Our podcast is brought to you by our friends at Cannon and Dunphy, and we appreciate their support. Bob, we're doing this a little unconventionally today. I am sitting in my childhood bedroom in Burlington, Connecticut, looking outside at blizzard conditions with about a foot of snow coming down right now and 40-mile-an-hour winds, and you're back in Green Bay after a week at the Super Bowl. So if there's any audio problems, we apologize for that. But we're doing this from, you know, 1,000 miles apart. So how's it going, Bob?
Good, Mike. I'm in Green Bay, and it's about 6 degrees, beautiful sunshine. We've had no snow here for 2.5-3 weeks, Mike, something like that. I mean, you would know there's – I mean, it's just – nothing's melted. There's probably a foot of snow on the ground, but it's sunny and brisk.
Well, I'm jealous of the sunshine, Bob. We had actually, it was really weird. Yesterday was a beautiful day. It was 60 degrees, 62 actually, and now we have a foot and a half of snow that we're supposed to get, so it's been a weird day here. Well, so it's been a while since we've talked to our listeners here. It's been, what, 2.5 weeks since the NFC Championship game when the Packers lost to the Falcons, and at that point, you were the last to make a musical selection, so this week it was my choice, and I went with a remake of a classic song that you were familiar with. I chose Just the Two of Us, but I chose the modern version by Will Smith, and you were familiar, very familiar, with the version by Bill Withers. He's got a few good songs, Bob.
Yeah, Bill Withers definitely did. He's from the mid-70s, I'm guessing mid to late 70s. Liked the guy. Certainly heard a lot of his stuff, but I didn't know, I have to admit, I did not know Will Smith, the actor, was also an artist, an actor, a singer.
Yeah, he had a few different art albums early in the 2000s and late 90s, and he doesn't really do that much anymore, if at all. But yeah, he was actually pretty popular for a while there. One of his albums called Big Willie Style was among the most popular in the country when I was younger. I remember my dad actually bought it for me when I was maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. So it's been fun to listen to that song and compare it to the original, which is what I did this morning, to see which version I wanted to use. But I think we should probably discuss this Falcons game finally, since it's been so long since it happened and we haven't been back here with our listeners. So, well, I don't know what you remember about it, Bob, but I remember it it being over pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it was a travesty from start to finish. Crosby missed that field goal, and the defense couldn't do anything. And what was it, 21-0, Mike, I believe?
Yeah, and then it got up to 31-0 eventually.
Yeah, so it was a non-competitive annihilation, really.
Now, you know, going into the game, I don't really know what you expected, but me personally, I wouldn't have been surprised if either team won. I thought going into it that the Packers were going to be able to move the ball and score on a questionable Atlanta secondary, and obviously I thought Atlanta was going to be able to have some of the success that they eventually had, you know, when the game was played. But in either direction, I did not see a blowout coming. What did you sort of think going into it? I don't know necessarily who you thought would win, but did you see the victor being so dominant, regardless of which team it might have been?
No, I thought this was just a toss-up. I mean, I just kept going back to 2010 when Green Bay went down there and killed them 48-21. And I thought they had lost by one down there at midseason, and Green Bay had won 8 in a row, and out there ready to play excellent football. The Falcons had had a week off, right, Mike? Yeah. And I think that sometimes can – no, I'm sorry. They beat Seattle the week before. That's right. So I thought it was like just an even game, and I was pretty flabbergasted the way this thing turned out.
Now, did you when it got to halftime and it was a pretty lopsided game, did you think that it was over based on some of the early mistakes the Packers made, whether it was Crosby's missed field goal or the fumble by Aaron Ripkowski or some missed throws by Rodgers? Because, and we'll talk about this particular game later, but you just watched a Super Bowl in Houston where it got to halftime and it was very lopsided, and that game was far from over. So what did you think at halftime of the Packers game?
Well, it was 24-0. But I didn't think the game was over. No, I didn't. I think Green Bay had the ball first, maybe, in the third quarter.
They did, and then they went 3-and-out right away.
Yeah, and then they threw that touchdown pass to Julio Jones, I think, and that made it 31-0. Well, at that point, it was getting a little grim, but even at 24, I just expected this team to show some fight and to get back into it and put some stress on the Falcons to see how they would react under some pressure. It really never happened.
So when it comes to a game like this that's so lopsided and so, I guess, disparaging, really, if you're a Packers fan from start to finish, where does the blame lie in a situation like that? Is it poor preparation? Is it the players not being able to match the intensity of the moment? Is it Atlanta just coming out at a different level? How do you sort of dissect what went wrong?
I mean, when I had to do the rating the Packers that next day, Mike, and the stars of the game, I was at a quandary trying to pick one guy, let alone three. I mean, it was really difficult. The highest any position group got was two footballs for the D-line and the O-line. So I went with T.J. Lang. I mean, he got knocked out and missed a bunch of plays in that game. He only played 38 out of, I don't know, 56% of the snaps. I went with him number one. Jordy Nelson number two. I mean, he played with broken ribs. He deserves a lot of credit for that, but he wasn't a great player in this game. And then Don Barclay, who came off the bench late, I put him number three, but, I mean, he had played 50 snaps. I didn't think he was that great either, but there was just nobody else. And I guess that just kind of summarizes what I thought. It was just a terrible showing all the way around.
Well, you mentioned, Jordy Nelson playing with the broken ribs. So let's sort of talk about what they had at the receiver position. You know, going into the game, it was unclear if Nelson, Adams, or Geronimo Allison would be able to play. And then on Saturday around 2 o'clock, the Journal Sentinel reported that all three of those guys were at least going to give it a shot. And whether or not they would be effective was a totally different question, but they were at least going to get out there. And, you know, I'll give my impression and then you can give your impressions. I thought of the three, you know, Nelson was far and away the most effective, but that still doesn't say a whole lot because despite the tremendous pain that I'm sure he played through, he just was not able to do a lot of the things that he normally does. But when you look at the other two guys, Adams and Allison, part of me thinks it might have been better if those guys didn't even play. And I'm not saying that because they did anything to ruin the game or cost the game with tipped balls or anything like that. But, I mean, it was very clear that Adams had nothing off the line of scrimmage. And as we've talked about on this podcast before, if Adams can't beat you in the first 3 yards, he's not going to win a lot of routes unless it's a second reaction play where Rodgers is scrambling. And then Allison was constantly grabbing at his hamstring throughout the game, so it was clear that he was uncomfortable. And I just wonder, I don't think the game would have been different from an outcome standpoint. I still think they would have lost. But I wonder if the offense would have had a little bit more explosiveness if they rotated in some other guys, or maybe they play Montgomery a little more at receiver, or at least give, you know, Trevor Davis maybe more than two or three snaps. I mean, what is your philosophy, I guess, on playing guys that are starters that are badly hurt in playoff games, but giving them a chance just because of who they are?
Yeah, I hear you, Mike. You pointed a lot of that stuff. We were sitting next to each other in the press box, and I didn't really see Allison, but then you pointed it out, and then I started to see it. So what are the options? Jeff Janis or Trevor Davis? They were both active, I believe.
And then using Ty Montgomery, I guess, and Jared Cook and Richard Rodgers, you know, just basically – trying to piece together anything you can.
Yeah, Rodgers only played 16 snaps that day. But then if you take Montgomery out of running back, of course he was in and out with injuries in that game, you know. Christine Michael, I mean, I don't like him, and Rutkowski. I mean, he shouldn't be in a game as a one-back, a game of that caliber as a one-back. I mean, that's kind of farcical in a way, too. So, I don't know. They were just kind of caught, and they were a little thin, and but they had Aaron Rodgers, who was certainly healthy, and he didn't make hardly anything happen either, Mike.
No, he didn't. And, you know, that was one thing that I thought was interesting. You know, McCarthy, I can't remember if it was his post-game press conference or the press conference he had later in the week sort of to wrap up the whole season. But he said that he thought Rodgers played an incredible game. And he said, you can throw the stats out the window and all that kind of stuff. But I looked at the intensity and the effort with which he played against the Falcons. And he said, I thought Rodgers took his game to another level. And granted, you and I don't get to see the preparation. We don't get to hear the things that Rodgers might be saying to his teammates or in meetings and things like that. But I just don't understand how McCarthy can make a comment like that, given the fact that Rodgers was well below average and well below any standard he should set in the playoffs against what is, quite honestly, a very mediocre defense.
I mean, Dan Quinn just fired the coordinator, Richard Smith, here yesterday. Not a great defense. It's a fast defense, but it wasn't great. Rodgers just wasn't sharp throwing the ball or recognizing the blitzes that that they sent. And he made a lot of poor throws. And I don't know what McCarthy's talking about with all that stuff, but who knows sometimes what he's talking about, you know?
Definitely. One of the factors that I wondered how much it played with Rodgers from a mental standpoint was the injuries along the offensive line. Now, the reason I bring that up is because we saw last year that without Nelson and without Adams, there were times when he didn't really seem to trust anybody to throw the ball to. And this year, even though he had those guys out on the field, you know, Adams, Nelson, and Cobb were out there, I just wondered if the mental doubt started to creep back in when it came to the offensive line. And, you know, you have, so who was knocked out of this game? You had Lang knocked out, you had Bulaga knocked out, and then Lane Taylor, right?
Yep, that's right.
So all three of those guys. Now, I'm not saying that Rodgers should be back there thinking he has the same quality of protection that he has with his starters, but I do wonder if he sort of got the same accelerated clock uneasiness that we saw last year once those guys started to go down.
I don't know. I have no real thought on that, Mike. The line wasn't good. Bakhtiari had one of his worst performances of the year against Dwight Freeney, the 36-year-old spin artist. Tyson Jackson, to that huge guy, slammed Bakhtiari inside for a sack. There were some low snaps by Corey Linsley. I mean, he didn't have a bad snap, a fumble snap all year that was charged to Linsley, but there were a few low and slow there. So, you know, I mean, it wasn't easy street for Aaron Rodgers with what he had around him, but when you're Aaron Rodgers, you have to play above all that stuff and in moments like this, and he didn't.
I will say this, though, and we talked about this after the Dallas game. I don't know how he manages to hang on to this ball on these blindside blitzes where Brian Poole comes off Rodgers' left side and just absolutely drills him in the back. I mean, if you talk about, you know, fumbling against Dallas or fumbling against Atlanta, I mean, these, first of all, they probably don't beat Dallas if he fumbles. And second of all, if he fumbles against Atlanta there, I mean, this game gets even more and more lopsided. So it's just, I mean, he took some big hits in that game. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. He wouldn't have had to take that hit if he would have just recognized that blitz better, but he just didn't. He had no idea Poole was coming, and he has to be aware of those kind of things.
Yeah, a lot of the hits that he took against Dallas and against Atlanta came off blitzes by defensive backs, whether it was corners or safeties, you know, coming from that slot kind of position. And I wonder if that's something that the Packers will see a lot of in the early weeks of next season, because that was clearly an area where their protection schemes were exposed in the playoffs.
That's a good point, Mike, and I'm sure, I think you're right. They will see that, I would think, in September next year, right?
Definitely.
Yep, good point. Well, anything else from this game, Mike?
Yeah, I want to talk just briefly about the defense. Let's talk about the way this season ended for the cornerbacks. Of course, Ladarius Gunter remained the number one and had to shadow Julio Jones for basically the second time this season. And then you had Demarius Randall as the number two. Quentin Rollins played very briefly coming back from that concussion and neck injury. And then Micah Hyde was probably the steadiest guy they've had in terms of consistent presence and consistent performance. But it was just kind of a rough day all the way around. Personally, I understand that Gunter has a job to do in covering Julio Jones and covering Odell Beckham, covering Dez Bryant. But honestly, when the season ended, I felt bad for him a little bit because this is a guy that, based on his talent level, really got the short end of the stick, not only with injuries, but also with the massive regressions by Demarius Randall and Quentin Rollins, so that this guy, Ladarius Gunter, who's probably a number four or number three corner at best, is being asked to do things that, no matter how hard he prepares and how hard he tries, his body just can't do them. And so I just wonder if at all he's going to be shaken mentally moving forward by a season that probably rattled him on a number of occasions.
Yeah, I hear you, Mike, and I had those same thoughts about Gunter myself. But, you know, it's really balanced by just a guy like that getting this chance, a chance of a lifetime to play whatever, I don't know, 88% or 90% of the snaps. I mean, you know, you just got to come through, and he proved himself. I mean, he's a number three, I would say, or a four, you know, but I mean, he's not a one, obviously, but yeah. He played pretty well. I think I gave him a C. We'll talk about that in the ensuing weeks. But, yeah, I know. And he had an impossible matchup in this game. And Randall was just awful again in this game. So, and then Hyde got hurt, and Rollins was okay. And it was just a mess, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Demarius Randall, to me, is the most shocking. And I thought you sort of nailed it head on. I can't remember if it was in your rating the Packers or your final season grades, but I think you said that he carries himself like with the bravado of a number one cornerback, but performs like something much less, I think, to paraphrase essentially what you said. And I just thought his play this year was downright shocking, honestly, because, yeah, he tailed off toward the end of last season. There's no doubt about it. But, I mean, he flashed the type of talent and sort of, you know, ballsiness, for lack of a better term, to go up against some of these better receivers. I mean, he got lit up by Amari Cooper, but he kept fighting play after play and was just pissed at himself for getting beat. And this year, it felt like whenever he got beat, there was always an excuse, whether it was an injury or, you know, that wasn't the correct coverage or whatever the case may be. If I'm in that Packers organization, I'm a little concerned about the way he approached this season mentally and the way this season did not seem to bother him at all mentally, given the amount of mistakes and poor performances he exhibited.
I mean, he seemed to feel pretty good about his performance in Atlanta after that game. I spoke with him. I think you did too, right, Mike?
No, it was our colleague Tom Silverstein, but he told Tom that he thought he played a good game and didn't remember getting beat at all in man coverage.
Quite upbeat when I spoke with him as well. We'll talk about the future, but I mean, there's just no way they can enter next season without a veteran cornerback.
I agree.
I mean, they'd be foolhardy to ever think that. So, but we can look. People know the depth chart. We know the depth chart. We can discuss that later on.
Anything else you want to talk about from that game in particular, or do you want to zoom out a little bit and look at the season as a whole?
I mean, Mason Crosby, that was a terrible miss.
Right? Oh, that's right.
41
yep.
yards early.
Yep.
The guys had a good year, but you just can't miss that kick, and that was a depressing thing, I'm sure, for the whole team. There were just mistakes all over the place. Missed tackles on special teams. I don't know. Clinton Dix was all confused about where to line up on that onside kick, and Crosby got the delayed game penalty trying to direct him. That shouldn't be going on in game 19 either, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It was a disaster.
The Crosby thing is interesting because sometimes, you know, you'll hear people say, well, you know, it was only a field goal. It was only 3 points. It was so early in the game, it shouldn't have mattered. But, you know, a lot of times, just from a mental standpoint, if you can get anything on the board it's a significant boost compared to going into halftime with nothing. I mean, if you talk about New England going in without that field goal that they had before the break, does that change the outcome of the game? Maybe not, but it's certainly just, it's just a little reassuring that you didn't get shut out completely going into halftime. And, you know, I'm a big soccer fan, as I've said on this podcast. And if you watch a game where a team's up 2-3, 4-0 in the first half and another team can just get one before halftime, it's such a different mindset than coming out in the second half knowing that not only are you down, but you couldn't even get anything by the opposing goalkeeper. So I think it actually matters to get that field goal early in the game. I don't know what you think, but that's just my two cents.
No, I agree. Speaking of soccer, West Ham's made a nice charge, and Leicester City, Mike, they're not going to get relegated, are they?
I don't know. That would be pretty remarkable if they went from winning the English Premier League last year to getting relegated this year, but they're in some serious trouble. I'm glad you're keeping up with the Hammers, though, Bob. Somebody needs
to.
Thank
you, Mike.
Anything else about the Falcons?
No, my thoughts on the Falcons go to the Super Bowl, but no, nothing from this title game, no.
All right, we'll get to the Super Bowl in a minute, but let's first talk about just sort of our impressions of the season overall. And we'll start, I guess, by offering up the comments that Mike McCarthy made in his season-ending press conference. It was the very first question, and he was basically asked, well, how do you see this season? Some people believe it's a failure because you didn't make or win the Super Bowl. Other people think it's a success because going from 4-6 to the NFC title game was certainly an impressive turnaround. And McCarthy said, you kind of have to look at it two ways. He said, on the one hand, our ultimate goal never changes. We want to win the Super Bowl, and we're not afraid to say those things, and so we won't back down from it when we don't reach that goal. But on the other hand, I don't think there's any way you can argue that this wasn't a successful season, he said. And so what do you think, Bob? Where does this season lie on the McGinn success meter?
Well, I thought about it for a full week after that Atlanta game, Mike, and I, you know, eventually had to do those Packer team grades, and I gave them a B-. They won the division. They were the number, what seed, Mike? Number
five? Was it five?
Well, they won the division. They must have been
four. I'm sorry.
Yep, right. And they won 8 in a row. So, you know, there were some gains made. On the other hand, they may have been the league's most disappointing team after 10 games when they were 4-6. It was an awful start. That team never should have lost 6 of the first 10 games. It's a ridiculous place to be with that talent and that quarterback playing all the time. The injuries, they got a good run on injuries this year. 19 teams were hit harder by injury than the number 20 Packers, according to mangameslost.com. I think they do a pretty good job looking at not just quantitatively, but qualitatively. Looking at impacted players, not just numbers. They were 11-7-1 against the spread. They won two playoff games for only, I think, the second time in Mike McCarthy's history. That was an accomplishment, certainly. They beat a good Dallas team. And then with a Super Bowl berth at hand, they got annihilated. And that's a real blot on it. So I gave them a B-. You know, McCarthy said after that game, he said, what a great season. I don't know if I've ever been more proud of a football team. It will always be a special football team. That's just noise from a podium, Mike. You know, I mean, they're a B-minus team that had their share of ups and their share of downs. They made the playoffs for an 8th straight year, and that's an accomplishment, and that's why they got the B-.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I think that the way I view it is any team that has the talent that this team had and the expectations that this team had and the organizational top-to-bottom willingness to discuss the desire and the goal of winning a Super Bowl year-round. I mean, it's not like this is a team that only talks about winning the Super Bowl once the playoffs start. This is a team that talks about winning the Super Bowl when their off-season program starts in March or February or whatever it is. And so, from that respect, if you're going to put that notion out there on a day-by-day basis, 365 days a year, I think it's hard to argue that anything less than that can be deemed a success, because you are saying to everybody that our only purpose is to win a Super Bowl. And if we don't do that, then what did you do? And so I think maybe I'm a little bit more harsh in that area than some others. But I mean, if this was a team that didn't talk about the Super Bowl as much or didn't bring it up as often, you know, world championships, bringing the trophy back to where it belongs, all that kind of stuff, if that's minimized or muted altogether, then I don't think there's nearly as much of a desire by people on the outside looking in at this season to say that it was a failure, because they haven't outlined what the ultimate goal is ad nauseum the way that they currently do. And so from that standpoint, I think that they should have at least made the Super Bowl in order for an argument to be made that it was a successful season. But that said, I thought the turnaround from 4-6 to 10-6 was remarkable. Even when they started to win 2 and 3 games in a row, I never thought they would win 6 in a row. So that took me by surprise. Some of the performances they got this year, I was impressed with. I never thought Davante Adams would be as good as he was this year, given the way he played last season. I didn't think Jared Cook was going to be as influential as he wound up being down the stretch. And again, we'll talk more about these players over the next 2 weeks when we break down the offense and the defense in two separate podcasts. But I guess my overall impression is, while there were certainly things to be happy with, I don't think you can be happy with the season overall.
Agreed, and it wouldn't have taken much, and that was the theme of my postseason column 7 days after that defeat. It wouldn't have taken much to put them over the top. It's just add a player here, add a player there. You get home field, you get the Falcons up here. You don't lose 6 of your first 10 games, and then maybe that NFC title game is a different outcome. Maybe not. Atlanta's a good team, but they're a different team on Lambeau Field Tundra late in the year than they are down there in that dome. And then you get to the Super Bowl. And you got 2 weeks to prepare and to heal up and all this. Who knows how they would have done against New England? I mean, they would have been an underdog, and they probably would have lost, but who knows? And then they had a chance for the 14th championship in their franchise history. But just to get beat 44-21, a horrible defeat. And, I mean, it's the worst playoff, third worst in history, I think it was. I don't know. I can't remember those numbers now, Mike. But, to deem anything really successful, highly successful, after 44-21, that's just beyond me.
What do you, you've been around McCarthy much longer than I have. We've heard what he said at the podium after the game. We've heard what he said at the podium later in the week for his season-ending press conference. But I mean, this is a guy that can get very heated about certain things. Do you think behind closed doors he was fuming with the way this season ended, or do you think he kind of resigned to the fact that his team just ran out of gas and ran into a better football team?
I just would not even be able to guess at that, Mike.
Yeah.
Mike McCarthy has a big temper, and he's worked very hard to curb it over, his head coaching career in Green Bay. It used to flare up a lot as an assistant. He admitted it, hurt him a little bit, and he had to settle down. I think he has. We really don't see almost no evidence of that. So how he was behind closed doors, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, how do you see it, Mike? You attend a lot of those press conferences during the season.
He just strikes me as such a competitive guy. And I mean, that sounds so cliche, because this is the National Football League, and if you're not competitive, you're not going to be in that position. But I mean, this is a guy where you look at practice back even during training camp, and he'll scream at, the third and fourth and fifth string offensive linemen for screwing up in the half line drill, things like that. And so I just find it hard to believe that a guy like Mike McCarthy can get on a plane from Atlanta back to Green Bay and not be really, really heated, at least for a little bit of time. And if he isn't, and if he is more accepting of the fact that, the injuries to the receivers, the offensive line, the fact that Atlanta was the best offensive team in the league, if he's accepting of those things, I just think it's a little out of character for him. So I have no idea if he was angry or not, but based on being around him and the way he can get even just a little bit prickly when you ask him a question he doesn't like that's critical of his team maybe in a certain way, just in the middle of the regular season. I just don't see how he can't be pretty heated after a loss like that.
Yeah. So then, you know, the other main man is Ted Thompson, and we don't really know what he thinks about this season or this defeat yet, do we?
No, we don't. Ted won't speak again until the combine later this month, toward the end of February.
So, okay, and then Mark Murphy would be the head of the organization, the Packer president, Mark Murphy, and he did an interview last week. I didn't attend that. You didn't either. You read it. What did you make of Murphy's remarks, Mike?
Well, they were pretty similar, honestly, to what McCarthy said. And I don't know if that was a party line that he was just, you know, happy to toe because McCarthy already put it out there. But, I mean, he sort of said the same thing, that, you know, it was definitely a successful season. He hears all the frustration from fans and season ticket holders that think that they're, you know, wasting Aaron Rodgers' prime and all of this, all these repeated storylines that, you know, get brought up seemingly year after year. But I think the one quote from him that sort of stood out to me is that he said something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't have it in front of me. He said, I hope it hasn't gotten to the point that every season is a failure unless we win the Super Bowl. And to me, that sort of meshed perfectly with something you wrote and that you sort of picked up on from a Sports Illustrated piece by Austin Murphy, where he said that, you know, the Packer fans basically live in entitled town, as in they're entitled to all of this success based on the tremendous run of quarterback play that they've had under Favre and Rodgers. And I kind of think that's accurate. You know, I think these fans have gotten to the point, and not unreasonably so. It's not like this is the Tampa Bay Buccaneers fans demanding they win the Super Bowl every year. I think they've fairly come to expect deep postseason runs given the talent at quarterback and the talent on the rest of the roster. And so for Murphy to say that they can still find success without winning the Super Bowl, it almost seems like he's trying to temper expectations. And I just don't think you want to do that if you're viewed as one of the top four or five franchises in the league.
Pretty much agreed, Mike. They have unbelievable resources in Green Bay. They're making, what, $45, $50 million a year. They're always way ahead of the cap, thanks to Russ Ball and Ted Thompson. I give them both credit in that regard. They've done a terrific job with the cap. There's no cash flow problems in that organization. They can do anything they want. They have no interference. So, you know, McCarthy and Thompson, they have a lot of advantages others don't. And every road game, Mike, we see it. We saw it, road games, 9 of them this year, 10 of them. We saw fan support everywhere. Everywhere. And that's a huge factor for a franchise when it goes on the road to have those supportive fans, 10, 12, 15, sometimes 20,000. They have that. Nobody else has that. Their facilities, everything is all football. There's no owner to cater to hassle you. They should win right now. This isn't the Packer team that I started covering when I got on the beat, Mike, with an old beat-up stadium and terrible facilities and no money and no Packer Pro Shop and all those disadvantages and no cash flow, trying to compete in an era when there was no salary cap and just get blown away by Eddie DeBartolo and the 49ers and the New York Giants and even the Dallas Cowboys, Tex Schramm and Bum Bright and people like that. No, this is Green Bay is in an enviable position, and there are scouts around the league who have told me that many, many times over the years. And they're envious of Green Bay, and I think, you know, the people that run the show in Green Bay should never forget that. They're in great jobs, and they need to win and win big.
I agree, especially if you're going to build the area around your stadium as what could be a future vacation destination for people with all these different attractions and things like that and the Hall of Fame Museum that they have and everything. You got to win to back that up, and, you know, first and second round exits in the playoffs are not going to do it. So it'll be interesting to see how and if that mentality or that that approach shifts as, you know, Rodgers enters what is definitely now the second half of his career, as opposed to, you know, the first half. He's certainly closer to the end than he is the beginning. And I'll be interested to see how those expectations or that mindset shifts at all, if and when his play starts to decline.
Yep.
Anything else you want to talk about for the season overall?
The season in general, huh, Mike? Well, we touched on the injuries a little bit. You know, this team ended up with 15 rookies on the 53-man roster for that Atlanta game, Mike.
Wow.
15. Of the 12 roster additions after opening day, 9 came directly from the practice squad. I know there's a lot of that around the league, but there's not that much around the league.
So who are the other three? There was Jarrell Presley, Kristen Michael, and then who was the third that I'm missing?
Well, I can't remember. Jordan Tripp.
Yes, Jordan Tripp. Good call.
Right.
So of those three that I mentioned, almost none of them had any reasonable impact.
Right. Yeah, they didn't get much impact from anybody this year. A little bit in the draft and the trade for Nile Davis. He returned him. Kristen Michael, that's why the personnel moves were given a D in the final grade, you know.
Yep.
Coaching B minus. The passing offense was a B. Rushing offense a C minus. Pass defense a D. Rush defense a B as in boy. Special teams a C.
Now, I know that we've I asked you the same question last year, and it, in some ways I guess it's more applicable to the player evaluations, which we'll discuss in the coming weeks. But what is it, in your grading scale, A through F, what is considered NFL average? Would that be a C, a B?
Well, at Michigan, Mike, I work so hard sometimes for a C, and I never forgot that. I mean, I'm not a real science guy, and I had a class, I had to take a science that first year, and I don't know, I can't even remember what it was, physical geography or something, something to stay away from the real tough stuff, and so I could concentrate on the English and the history and the poli sci. And I just remember being in an absolute panic in that competitive situation my freshman year, and going in at night and getting tutoring from those TAs and all that kind of stuff. And I got a C in that class, and I used to tell my mom on the phone what I was trying to struggle through, and I never felt better about a grade in my life, and that was a C. And I just kind of remembered that when I do these grades. I can't stand grade inflation. It drove me nuts with my kids all through their schooling. You do kind of nothing, and you get an A-minus or something, or a B-plus, and the scale goes way up. So I can't really tell you. I know I have the same criteria in my mind for all these years doing these grades. And to me, a C is pretty solid. And a B is great. And an A is just off the charts. I gave 2 A's this year. There's been some years where I gave 1, I think. So that's kind of my mindset. Maybe I didn't explain it very well, but
A C is pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay. See, when I was first hired here and it was in the summer, I think it was, or early spring, late spring rather. You sent me in the mail a bunch of stuff to sort of help me get ready for the season, and that included your grades from the past year and your statistical breakdown and that kind of stuff, just to familiarize myself with some of the players and things like that. And when I saw a bunch of guys that, you know, from afar I thought were pretty good players getting C's, my first reaction is that that wasn't very good. And so I think it's important to explain that even just once a year, because I think that some people will read it and see a C as not being very good.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I've always kind of hoped that they've read me enough over the years that they know where I'm coming from, and they just kind of get all that background stuff. It's kind of like an old shoe. They just kind of know me now, you know. But, to give Brian Balaga a B, that's a heck of a year. And let me just see a... We'll go through all this later, but Lane Taylor got a C, and that's a good grade. I mean, he was clearly their fifth best offensive lineman, but a C as a first-year starter, I thought he played good. I mean, there's room for him to grow now and to improve. But so that's it. I mean, TJ Lang, a B+. I mean, he had a great year. I mean, he wasn't at Bakhtiari's level, the A-, but we can talk about that later. But that's kind of the scale or the thinking in my head anyway.
Bob, is it true that you have grades for Tom and I as well?
No, I can't say that. And I never grade myself, Mike. That'd be really bad.
All right, we're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll come back and talk about the Super Bowl and some of the newsy items that have taken place in the last couple days.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
So, Bob, you just returned from Houston earlier this week where you saw the Patriots win an exciting Super Bowl. They knocked off the Falcons with a dramatic comeback. And pretty much all of the media coverage since then, at least in my part of the country here in Connecticut, has been focused on Tom Brady being the greatest of all time. With this win, he's certainly amongst the all-time greats at that position and maybe the all-time greats regardless of position. What do you think about, the ability of Brady to win the way he has? And where do you think he sort of, mixes in with some of the legends that we've heard about, for the last century, half century?
Yeah. Well, Mike, I'm not forgetting about Joe Montana. He was my number one in that Super Bowl book for performances in Super Bowl. And all time, I had him number one when I wrote that column. York at that Super Bowl, 3 years ago. He's 4-0 in Super Bowls. He's so mobile. He could run. He was smart. He had more than a good enough arm. Poetry in motion, as Bill Walsh described him once. Brady's 5-2 in Super Bowls. He's played a long time. He's won a ton of playoff games. He's got more victories than anybody else. He's really, really good, isn't he, Mike? That second half, he just put sitting in that press box, he's just putting those balls on people. He just goes back there in that overhand delivery, just on people, man. And Atlanta, they covered pretty darn good, Mike, in their man scheme underneath there. I mean, Poole and Alford and Collins, I thought they all covered pretty good. Even the linebackers. I mean, Jones and Campbell can run. There's not that many windows in that thing. He put a lot of balls on the right side of receivers and just hit them in stride. He had 4 or 5 drops. But anyway, I still would go Montana 1, Brady 2 right now. That's just me. And then I got, the next three would be Unitas and John Elway. I'm a Dan Marino guy. I love him. And then you're talking Peyton Manning and Otto Graham, Brett Favre in that 6, 7, 8 category. So, how do you see it, Mike? How did you see Brady the other day?
Well, I think the thing that stands out to me most about Brady is the way he can, at age 39, still make every throw he wants to make with the exact velocity or loft or whatever the situation calls for, he can do it. And the reason why I think that stood out to me so much is the juxtaposition of last year's Super Bowl when Peyton Manning looks like he can't complete a 20-yard pass anymore. And so you look at, Manning, of course, he had all of those neck surgeries and some extenuating injury factors that I'm sure robbed him of some of the zip that he had when he was younger. But I just thought the crispness with which Brady throws the football at that age is just remarkable, especially because he threw, 63 passes? It's not like the guy only made 20 throws. I mean, after 63 passes, you're going to be pretty tired. And he looked like he could keep going for another 2 quarters if he had to.
Is there a lot to be said for his ability to come back in that game? He's had a million comebacks in his career, right? He's a cutthroat competitor. You see the primal screams and the eye black and just the leadership. He's got that big towering presence. I'm sure he can be intimidating to some young teammates. The guy just keeps going and going and going, doesn't he? He just battles, man.
Well, I think
he hit him and bang him around in the pocket. He's like Dan Fouts. He stands in there and he takes a lot of abuse, but he doesn't really care, and he's gonna and you're going to get them for interceptions, and you're going to get some bad balls off the guy just because he can't really escape. There's no question. But he's going to keep coming back at you, you know?
What did you think of him when he was at Michigan, Bob?
I wish I remembered more about that. You know, Tyler Dunn, our buddy Mike, he interviewed Drew Henson, the number three guy capture, and some receivers from Brady's past a week ago, and I think he wrote that on Bleacher Report this week. I want to read that. I haven't yet. He was really up to date on that. He talked to Henson after the game. But I just don't remember. I kind of fell away from Michigan football there in that era. Just kind of disappointing. I guess I got a little greedy, too, and just kept expecting national titles. And so I just cannot really remember a lot about Brady at Michigan. I'm sorry.
I think part of the reason he deserves credit for the comeback is because, and this argument is constantly brought up when people compare Brady and Rodgers, is just the quality of weapons around Brady over the last few years relative to the talent that Rodgers has had. I mean, you look at some of the receivers that, you know, Brady has to play with. Chris Hogan, the former lacrosse player. Danny Amendola, just sort of your run-of-the-mill guy, nothing really that spectacular. And then Edelman, I think, is probably among the better, if not, you know, the best players in the league at his position. You know, Martellus Bennett, certainly a serviceable tight end, as Packers fans remember from seeing him in Chicago for so many years. But his top target, Gronkowski, is out for, you know, the last, what is it, 8 games of the season or 6 games?
11.
11, there you go. And they won all of them, didn't they? Yeah, so, I mean, it's just, I'm impressed year after year with the numbers he puts up with basically no legitimate number one receiver since Randy Moss left.
And, Mike, you got to look at the offensive line in New England. I mean, Belichick has basically just turned it over to Dante Scarnecchia and said, hey, we're not really going to have much here, and they never have. I mean, this line, you got this free agent guy, David Andrews, at center. A scout last 2 weeks ago broke down all these players for me. Shaq Mason, undersized guard. You got Tooney at left guard. I mean, he's an athletic, but he's a rookie guy. Marcus Cannon really didn't play well at all for his first 3 or 4 years. He's been okay this year. And Nate Solder is a good left tackle. But all their linemen over the years, you think of that Wendell and just go on and on. They don't have great offensive linemen. It's nothing like Green Bay's had.
No, I mean, you're definitely right, and that contributes to what you said a couple minutes ago, in that part of the impressiveness of Brady is his ability to take all these hits that are partly due to an inexperienced and, you know, not that talented offensive line, and just continue to throw and throw and throw. And not only that, but they sort of do it with an atraditional, you know, running game. I mean, the running game that the Packers had this year is not altogether that different from what the Patriots sort of have in most seasons. You know, they've got their big bruising back in LeGarrette Blount that they use in short yardage and especially around the goal line. And I think he had, you know, double-digit touchdowns this year. It was a good season for him. And then their other two guys, Lewis and White, are sort of these receiving guys that, you know, you can give them a few carries, but they're not going to get 15 or 20 carries. So they're doing it with a questionable offensive line, with not a lot of talent at wide receiver, and with a running game that is not necessarily traditional as it would compare to many other teams in the league. So I'm just very impressed by what Brady does.
Deion Lewis was cut by a couple teams. James White, the Badger, a 6th-round pick, Mike. I remember all the scouts, they all just kind of poo-pooed the guy. I mean, yeah, they liked him as a college player, versatile in Madison. But there was nobody would ever see him catching 14 passes in a Super Bowl, running the winning touchdown in, looking like a good football player. You know, and this is Josh McDaniels and Belichick and Brady believing in this guy and getting the absolute best out of him. Kind of a remarkable deal.
So let's talk about two other guys that you wanted to discuss on this podcast as it relates to the Patriots. And we'll stick in this game for the moment. So one of the additions that you've talked about, and one of maybe the key differences between the way Belichick operates as coach and general manager and the way Ted Thompson operates as GM of the Packers, is the decision to go out and get a guy or bring in a guy like their cornerback Eric Rowe. Why does that move strike such a chord with you as somebody who's seen the way teams are built, and how did that influence what they did down the stretch?
Well, in 2015, that Packer pick came down to Demaryius Randall or Eric Rowe, a cornerback safety from, Utah, maybe, or something. Eric Rowe is from Utah, right. And Rowe had even better size than Randall, 6 foot, 1 half inch. I think he's 205. He ran well, 4.41, very good athlete. Played some safety, played some corner. Well, he goes to Philadelphia in the second round, number 47, after Randall went 30 to Green Bay. And the Eagles, he didn't do much as a rookie. And now they got a new defensive coordinator, Jim Schwartz, who just, for some reason, just, you know, he wasn't there when they selected him, and he just didn't really see much future for him. And they had some players at corner, and they just somehow made it known that they wanted to move Eric Rowe. And for whatever reason, and Schwartz and Belichick go back to Cleveland, gave him his first NFL job. All of a sudden, on September 7th, a couple days after the final roster reduction, the two teams make a trade. Now, at that point, New England's cornerback depth chart was about the same as Green Bay. I mean, Sam Shields was there, but, you know, Shields had 4 concussions at that point. Don't know about his longevity. And, you know, I mean, New England had Malcolm Butler and Logan Ryan, and they had a second-round pick, Cyrus Jones. Interesting, though. You know, Cyrus Jones, a second-round pick, he was inactive for the Super Bowl. So they kind of knew right then that he wasn't playing that well. And so they made a trade. And they get a guy who was drafted number 47. They give up a fourth-round pick in 2018. So that extra year really makes it a 5. It could improve to a 4. Let's call it to a 3. I mean, let's call it a 4 in today's, with the present value factored in, for Eric Rowe. Well, Rowe sits out the first 5 games in New England, just learning the system, picking it all up. Now, you saw him in the Super Bowl, Mike. He's been their nickelback, their number 3 corner for the last 11 or 12 games. They would have been hard-pressed to handle that Falcon passing game without Eric Rowe. I mean, the guy played well, and he's a tremendous-looking athlete. He's sleek, and he's going to get better. Now, he's not a great player now by any means. I'm not saying that. But for the cost of a fourth-round pick, get a player like Eric Rowe and add him to your collection of corners, I mean, he would have been far and away better than anything the Packers had this year. These are the kind of moves that just Belichick will make. I mean, he's constantly tinkering. It's exactly the way Ron Wolf used to build his roster and build his team. And it's the complete opposite of the way Green Bay builds its team. They just would never have made a move like that. I don't even know if they're aware of, or even anymore, if there's any movement or push within that personnel department to think about these things. I mean, nobody's done any of this for years, for 20 years, and I don't know. I mean, Ted says everything is being brought to him all the time. Well, we have no idea if that's the truth or not. And so Rowe's on that field for a Super Bowl winning team, and he's got a ring, and it's a great move.
Now, contrast that a little bit with a move that has impressed you now that the season is over. What about the addition of tight end Rob Housler, signing him to a futures deal, essentially? Why does that jump out to you?
So Housler's 28, and the Patriots signed him on Monday or Tuesday, a list of 9 guys to futures contracts. So it means when the league year starts, March 9 or 10, whatever it is, he's on the 90-man roster. Well, Housler's 28. Been around the league for 5 years, 2 or 3 teams, but he can run. He's an athlete. Everybody has known this. That's why he was a third-round pick. I remember the scouts talking about this guy. He can run. He can get down the seam. He's a player. Now, he's not a blocker, and he's had some problems with drops, and that's why he's been around. He got cut by the Bears September 3rd, I think, and sat on the street all year. Okay. He's not a great player, but you got a problem with Gronkowski's back. And now Belichick, amid this Super Bowl hubbub and parades and all this stuff, he signs this guy. Now, there's no guaranteed money. He's 28. Belichick signs him because he's got a chance with the speed factor and the experience to add to the competitiveness of his offseason and training camp program and perhaps make the team. That's the kind of player Ted Thompson would never add to his 90-man roster. He signs guys from his practice squad, as Belichick does, and then he will sign in the next, he signed a long snapper here recently, but he will all sign guys that are 24 or under, and then he will sign 16, 17, as many as 18 or 20 undrafted college free agents, where Belichick will tinker in UFA. He's not going to spend big money, but he's going to get those second and third tier guys, and that's going to swell his 90. And they're going to get cut. He takes chances on these people. He'll sign guys that are 30 years old in August 1st, and they're there for 2 weeks. He just wants a look on the bottom of that 90-man roster. I don't know. I like what he does. That's the way I grew up with Ron Wolf doing it, adding people that have played the game, that have seasoning, that can bring fresh ideas to your locker room. I think fresh ideas are a plus, not a minus. Too much homegrown is just too much homegrown. Doesn't make sense to me. That's about it on Hausler. It's just a small name on a transaction list, but it's symbolic of an overall philosophy that's obviously the best in the NFL.
And we're going to have a chance to see if Ted makes any alterations to those philosophies that everyone has come to know over the last decade. And part of the reason for that is because of two moves that they've made in the last couple days that create some sizable holes on their 53-man roster, let alone their 90-man roster. So first, they decide to part ways with running back Sam Shields, who has still not cleared the concussion protocol after a car accident that he was involved in. I believe it was in early December or mid-December. And then yesterday, they get rid of Sam Shields, their veteran corner, their number one corner, who suffered his fifth documented concussion in week one and is out the remainder of the season, has still not cleared the protocol, and as of the NFC Championship game, was still experiencing headaches periodically. So that's obviously not a very good sign for him. So with those two guys gone, I mean, I guess first of all, did either of those moves surprise you? Maybe not the actual result, but the timing of these moves?
No, this is kind of way, you know, the Packers have operated. This is the time of year, right around this week and next week is when they just, you know, lop off players. It's just the way it goes, Mike, you know. I'm just going to add this, you know, that there was a defensive quality control coach on the staff, Ejiro Everill, who was announced yesterday by the Rams as their new safeties coach. That was the position, right, Mike?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. You know, why don't the Packers comment about these things? I mean, why wouldn't McCarthy or Thompson speak about, you got Sam Shields, a tremendous player here that's meant a lot. He helped this organization win a Super Bowl, get to all these postseasons. Through nothing he's done wrong, he suffers all these concussions. He gave his all for this organization, and nothing. I mean, they wouldn't take any questions on anything. It's absurd. He led them to a Super Bowl, Mike. He helped them immensely in that playoff run in 2010. He'll never be forgotten. He's the Chuck Mercine of 2010. And this guy was a really good guy around there, and he battled. He was a good number two. Last year he had 6 screen passes for 20 yards or more. He gets hurt. There's no alcohol involved in that crash he was involved in with the semi. He wasn't ticketed. Nothing he did. So he's out at night. Big deal. The game, you know, he's not working at that point. So what? No comment. And then Everill, a member of Mike McCarthy's staff for a year, he departs. Again, no mention of this, no nothing. It's like they live in a glass tower, a glass house, and they don't even acknowledge the contributions of these two outstanding players.
Yeah, that was surprising to me too. I was on the phone with our colleague Tom Silverstein last night, just catching up and saying hello, and we were just sort of shooting the breeze about the moves that were made, and he said, you know, I was surprised not to see any quotes, at least in the press release, you know, from Thompson or from McCarthy or anybody, a position coach, about either of these two guys, one being your number one corner who, you know, some people thought was a Pro Bowl caliber player and helped you win a Super Bowl, and the other, like you said, being a guy that wasn't a starter, but when you won a Super Bowl, he essentially was the starter for a lot of those playoff games. And so I was a little surprised. I wasn't surprised that there wasn't a press conference. I don't think they would ever do that. It's just not their style. And, you know, even though you and I might operate differently, it's just not the way that they do it. But I was surprised that there were no quotes in the press release, because if you think about last season, when they let go of their running backs coach Sam Gash and their tight ends coach Jerry Fontenot, there were quotes in those press releases from McCarthy saying, you know, we thank them for their service. We wish, you know, Jerry and his wife, or Sam and his wife and their family well, and all this kind of stuff. Nothing major, but just a paragraph or two. And to not have that for Shields or Starks, I thought was a little less professional than I would have expected.
It's a cool way of doing business, Mike. How do you think Demaryius Randall and Quentin Rollins and Ladarius Gunner, who were mentored by Shields last year and this offseason, they see the way Shields treated. Think them that makes them feel real happy to be with this organization? I wouldn't think so.
No, and it was
same with Eddie Lacy. I mean, he's close to Starks. Ty Montgomery's been around Starks. They know this is a good guy. Every player on offense and on that team knows Starks is a good guy. He is a good guy. I mean, he's been in tremendous shape. He's done everything possible. He's overcome all these injuries. Yeah, he had a bad year this year. I don't know. It just seemed like every time a run was poorly blocked, he had the ball. I mean, that's a bit of an excuse, and he didn't hit these holes as good, but so what, you know? And then nothing. Just gone.
Yeah, I mean, I could see not wanting to say anything about a guy if one of the players involved is a total knucklehead or had made all kinds of mistakes or just was an unpopular guy, but Starks is as popular a guy as you'll find in that locker room, and you were around Shields much longer than I was. You know, granted, he had that marijuana issue and those charges that he now faces stemming from, you know, earlier in January, but prior to that, everything I had heard in my 2 years was that Sam was a likable guy. He was, you know, a decent guy to talk to, mentored the young guys. You know him better than I did, but I mean, neither one of those guys seemed like problem children at all.
No. This front office, this management team, they set themselves apart from the media, apart from the fans, apart from their fan base. That's just the way they do business. And, you know, it's their call, but just I hope they don't expect to be characterized any way else than the way they are.
Well, I think we've definitely gone beyond what we normally do. We're already over an hour, Bob. But we did get one or two quick questions that I think are pretty interesting. So one of the ones I want to answer is from Seth Buffelli. And Seth wants to know, what are the potential consequences of not signing a veteran cornerback this offseason? Well, I think one of the consequences, the most direct and obvious one, is performances similar to what we saw down the stretch this year, where you've got young guys that are either A, not that good, or B, have the talent but have not yet developed into what they can be, put into positions like Ladarius Gunter or like Demaryius Randall when they're playing guys that are just better than them at this point in time. And so you might see some unsightly games in the back end of this defense. But what I think is the bigger factor, and I know you've written about this, Bob, and discussed it as well, is that I just think that with Shields gone all season, and not only gone from a playing standpoint, but physically gone, Shields spent almost the entire season at his home in Sarasota, Florida. If you take away the only veteran in that room, Joe Witt Jr., the position coach, can do as much as he possibly can to try and give these guys some leadership and some teaching and all those kinds of things that he's become good at over the years. But it's a whole different thing, guys have told me, to hear instruction and commentary and feedback from one of your peers than it is from a coach. And when Ladarius Gunter and Demaryius Randall and Quentin Rollins look around and they're the oldest guys in that room with the exception of Micah Hyde, who bounces back and forth, who are you turning to when you're in a rough patch? And so that, I think, was the bigger loss this year. It's just they didn't have anybody to teach them the ropes in only their second year in the league.
Interesting, Mike. Yep. They had Tremont Williams, Al Harris, Charles Woodson in the past in that room, and now there's nobody.
Yep. And then the one other question that I thought would be interesting to answer, and this is more of a little fun response here. I think you'd agree, Bob. There's a question from Keith Aaron, and Keith wants to know, how will Ted spend all of that cap money? How is he going to spend $40 million? And I think the answer is he's not. He's not going to spend all $40 million. What would you give, Bob, if Ted spent every dime he possibly could?
I'd like to make that bet. Now, he's got to spend some, Mike, because, you know, there's minimum spending requirements in that CBA. So he's got to do some of that to get the Packers up. He can't roll a whole bunch over next year. So I have no idea what he's going to do. I'm sure he likes his team just the way it is right now. He always does.
Definitely.
He's got 10 or 11 guys he signed already this year, you know, to the futures contract. I'm sure he likes them as well.
No doubt about it. And we got some other questions about specific free agents or areas of need, and those are all things we'll discuss in the coming weeks when we talk about different positions and things like that. And, you know, eventually down the road, Bob always gets into his free agents and the best guys at each position. So we appreciate those questions, but we won't answer them right now because they'll probably be addressed down the road in podcasts or in written stories. So we're not ignoring you guys, just not going to take those questions right now. But Bob, we're at an hour and 5 minutes. This might be an all-time record.
Mike, it's bad. We've got to cut back on this now.
I know. It's, you know, it's, people just missed us, Bob, and we're trying to give them what they wanted.
Yeah.
All right, so we will talk to everybody again next week, and on the way out, a little bit of Will Smith, just the two of us. See you guys later. Work out with me and your mom, but your push come to shove, you was conceived in love. So if the world attacks and you slide off track, remember one fact, I got your back. Just the two of us, we can make it if we try. Just me, just me and you. Just the two of us, against the world.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.